This is CliffCentral.com.
All right, let's kick off the leadership master, or the business masterclass. Welcome, and it's in association with USB Ed. Last week, recruitment and remuneration. Today's theme with Michael Hinton from USB Ed. Critical financial ratios in every business. How exciting. How interesting.
You have no idea.
I'm sure these gentlemen are going to wave their wand and make it exceptionally interesting, but certainly very crucial, very, very needed. Richard Angus, hi. Good to have you.
How's it, Adrian? How are you doing?
Good, good, man. And then Michael Hinton from USB Ed.
Nice to see you, Adrian.
Yes, nice to see you again. So, gentlemen, that's it. I don't know, make it easy, make it interesting for us, all these formulas we need. And just a reminder, in the second half of our business masterclass, we will interview an interesting man, Sakumzi Makubela of Sakumzi Restaurant. He's also chairman of JCCI Soweto branch, but a restaurant that's been around for a long time. And, you know, in the next hour, Richard Angus will mostly lead the conversations. So, yeah, stay with us. You're about to learn a lot.
Thanks, Adrian. Yeah, I think, you know, when we talk about business health and financial ratios, I think everybody's eyes glaze over instantly. And everybody's always kind of going, well, you know, is this my domain? Do I have to worry about this? But I think the reality is there's quite a let's call it simplicity when it comes to this the reality of financial ratios. Mike, I mean, just give me some insight here. I mean, when we start out, I think the thing for me is before we even get into ratios, there's this whole principle of how a business model actually works. And let's step back from, let's call it a straight ratio for a moment, and just talk about a relationship that's quite important for people to have a good grasp of. And that's that whole principle of, you know, what it costs you to run, or what you make from buying and selling a product versus the amount of the product you buy and sell.
Yeah, Rich, thanks. You've got a good point there. So I suppose the easiest way I think that we can look at it is let's look at a few examples of some businesses. So as you say, we've got and a principle that I like to use is the volume versus margin. So we think about when you talk about margin, that's our profitability on it. How much are we actually making from is this a high margin product? For every 100 rand that we actually sell it for, how much does it actually cost us and what profitability are we making? Versus what is the volume that we're making? How many times do we have to sell this thing in order to make it worthwhile?
So we're then looking at this element of, let's call it, high volume, low contribution. I guess the reality is there's very few businesses that are high volume and high contribution. I mean, would be a business made in heaven.
I sometimes tell some of my students that the easiest way to think about that kind of business is which products are get ripped off the most. So if you go into maybe Dubai or the East, what kind of products are getting ripped off? You can think of maybe your high-end perfumes or anything like that. So that's normally your high-volume, high-margin stuff. Mm. But when you talk about high-volume, low-margin, that's often your retailers, some of your big grocery stores. They don't make much, believe it or not. Everyone else is thinking how expensive food is, but believe it or not, those retailers actually don't make a lot of margin. But then they have to compensate with the volume. So Rich, that's how we work it. So it's high volume, low margin. Mm. Or on the other side, you're getting high margins, but low volume. Things like maybe your sports cars or if you're a shipbuilder or an aeroplane. Think about it. They make a lot of money. They don't sell that many.
Yeah, you're not buying those things. So I'll take three of those before I check out.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's move to this whole question of, and I mean, you often hear people talking about, well, my margin is X percentage. And then you hear people saying, well, my gross profit percentage is this. And then other people will say, well, I mark up my goods by a percentage. What do all these things mean? Because, I mean, everybody quickly flicks out these numbers and, you know, they go, I have a 30% I make a 50% margin on my business, or I have a gross profit percentage of you know, 30%, and they throw the numbers out and they say, I'm doing really well. People will look at them and go, well, how do you know that's the right number? And what does that number mean?
What exactly does that mean? That's great. So before people's eyes glaze over, let's talk a little bit about this. Now, if you had to look at your, say you got your bank statement. You don't even have a set of financial statements. You don't have income statement, balance sheet. If you just take your bank statement, have a look at the items on that bank statement and how many are in your control and how many are kind of not in your control. If you're a business, now, if you are selling baked beans, you buy some baked beans from a food supplier, that's not really in your control. However, when you go and rent a building or if you pay certain staff members or control the electricity, that is more in your control. So we've got two different types of expenses what we're dealing with in a business. We've got what we call a cost of sales. So that's almost what we're getting our supplies for, how much we're paying for the baked beans, and we're getting our operating expenses. So that's the first definition that we just need to decide. When we look at our bank statements, guys, how much is in your control versus how much isn't in your control? And then we've got two main profitability ratios that we're talking about. Our first one is our gross profit. How much did we buy the baked beans for? How much markup are we going to put on there? And for example, say we've bought the baked beans for R5, we're selling it for R10. We've made a gross profit of R5, or a gross margin. When you talk about our gross margin, 5 divided by 10 of 50%. So that's our first one. Gross margin is the top line figure. And then at the end of the day, we get our net margin.
Okay. And the net margin is after?
After all the other expenses have come off. Guys, and that's everything from taxes to interest charges to everything else that is in our control, more of our fixed costs.
Now, if I can just also interject here. So when we say, and using your baked beans example, the five rand cost of sale, 10 rand selling price, making us a R5 gross profit, if you were to then say, if somebody said to you, well, what is your markup in that case? That's 100% markup.
Absolutely, yes. So we take and
people, I think, confuse the margin or gross profit percentage number or percentage with markup.
Correct.
in their minds, and I think people think that those two things are the same, but they're
correct.
Not
correct. So if you have 100% markup, as you just said, with this example, you would have made a 50% margin. So
yeah,
5 plus 5 gives us the selling price, minus a 5 gives us the 50%.
Yeah. So and people mustn't get those terms interchanged.
No,
you know, they mustn't use them interchangeably because that could be really dangerous.
It can be.
If you commit to somebody, you say, oh well, I'll only I'm going to give you a 50, I'm going to charge a 50% markup, okay, in your baked beans example. If you bought the beans for $5, that means you can, you then charge the person R2.50 is your
profit,
exactly. is your gross profit. And then if you do the numbers, your gross profit percentage in that case now is significantly lower.
Correct, 100%. So if you want a certain profit percentage, in this case 50%, we need to work it out, and it's got to be significantly more than that you're going to be selling the product for.
Yeah. Now, I mean, Mike, give me some idea here. You know, people will say, well, what's a good GP to have and what's a bad GP? You know, my business has got a 15% GP, and I've heard somebody else saying they've got a 30% GP, and then somebody else marks up 100%. So, like, where am I at?
Where does it cut? And, Rich, that would really just depend on the different businesses. So when people ask me that question, what is a good gross profit? I say to them, look at your income statement, look at your bank statement. What other costs have need to come off? Because remember, we've only got one stab at getting the gross profit right.
Yeah,
you can
only sell the thing once.
You can only sell the thing once.
Once
exactly.
It's sold, it's gone.
After that, we need to have a look at what are your other expenses in this business. How much rent do you pay? What are your salaries? What are everything else? If those are small, then maybe you can afford to take a smaller cut. But if you have large expenses like that, you need to figure out, my gross profit has to be high enough so that when I take all of that off, I'm still left with something. At the worst case scenario, it's a break even. It's a zero.
And I guess we go back to that very first part of our conversation, and it's also obviously multiplied by the volume number.
100%.
So if the volume isn't right, if your volume's too low, and your gross profit percentages are low, you're not going to cover all of those fixed costs.
100%.
So you've got to get your volume and price numbers to work together and your profitability percentages.
I can make R2. I can make R1 on baked beans and still be profitable if I sell a heck of a lot of baked beans.
I was going to say, you're going to be selling lots and lots of baked beans.
I know, and we don't want to know where that goes. Okay.
Okay, so we've got our gross profit percentages. We then say you take off all your other operating expenses to get your net profit percentage. Now, this is all fine and well. This is all about profitability. But at the end of the day, when you sell items, we then start moving into this world of, well, I've got to buy something. So I use my resources to buy something. I then potentially sell it, or I provide a service. I've then got to either – so when I'm using my resources, I can either buy on credit or I can use my cash. I've then got to sell, find the client, sell to them. I've then got to collect that number or collect my selling price from the person that I've sold to, my customer. And I've then got to kind of convert it all the way back. Now, we refer to that as the working capital cycle in fancy terms. And I think it's also one of Adrian's famous things to talk about, is just how that cycle, particularly of getting payment as a small business in South Africa, is so problematic. Mm-hmm. Now, when it comes to ratios, what ratios should you be looking at in this world of working capital?
So we've got three particular working capital ratios, or what we call drivers. And I'm so glad you mentioned it, because it is so important. We see a lot of companies that in theory make a profit. So you look at the income statement, I have sold more than I have spent, so I have a theoretical profit. But many businesses out there will know that profitability doesn't equal cash. And it's exactly for the reason that you mentioned. Profit doesn't equal cash, because when we do take profit into consideration, there are the factors, the debtors, the creditors, the inventory. And I'll talk about that quickly. So mm-hmm. when we sell on credit, it's called a debtor or accounts receivable. So that's sitting in our balance sheet. It's, we have sold it to someone, they owe it to us in the future. Okay. Mm-hmm. Then we have our our creditors, which is our accounts payable. So we have actually used someone else's resource. Effectively, someone else has given me that can of baked beans. They said, don't pay me now, pay me in the future when you sell it. And the stock that we actually hold. And that's called our working capital cycle. Now, again, without confusing anyone, we need to work out on average, Richard, how long does it take us to collect our debt? So we've sold the can of baked beans. We've said to our guy, pay us in the future. How long on average does it take us to collect that cash? Is it the 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, whatever it is like that? So that's sold. Conversely, someone has given us the can of baked beans to sell. How long does it take us to pay them? Is it the 30 days, the 60 days, the 90 days? And those two levers work in conjunction with our inventory. Now, a lot of companies keep very high inventory. Now, realizing that inventory is another form of asset. So you actually either have inventory or you have cash. So when we convert the inventory, we convert it into cash. We look at lots of businesses, they've got a lot of inventory, but they are they don't have much cash. And that's one of the problems over there.
Mm. Now, surely, I mean, okay, so let's talk about ratios that one can use to measure this and compare entity to entity. Okay. How do you go about measuring these things?
So when we talk about our debtor's days, it's called our debtor's days, or our debtor's collection period.
Okay.
Now, if you look at a straightforward, it takes the balance sheet and the income statement. So balance sheet with all the debtors on versus the income statement with our sales. So the ratio we use is debtors divided by sales times by 365.
Hmm.
That gives us an average debtor's collection period.
Yep.
And with that, Rich, we want that to be as low as possible. Why do I say that? Why don't we want high debtors? And it's really because exactly that. If we have high debtors, it means that we don't have high cash.
Yeah, well, it's very simple. Money in my bank account and not in yours would be my comment.
So rather
the money in my pocket than in yours.
So you ask, what is a good ratio for that? We want that to be as small as possible. We don't want to keep a lot of debt in any business.
I must say, I have a business associate, one of our clients, and he has a very interesting way of collecting debtors that are really tardy. And I mean, this is happening at senior levels when things really go wrong. He'll pick up the phone and he'll phone the client and he'll say to them, I need to talk to you. You've got my money in your bank account, and I need to fix that problem. And yeah, sometimes it sounds a little personal, I guess, but it gets the message across. You've got my money in your bank account, and I need it in mine. Exactly. How are we going to do this?
Exactly. And the converse is true from a creditor's payment point of view. So we take our creditors, the final creditor's balance in the balance sheets, and if you want to, some people take opening creditors minus closing divided by two. Let's not go there. Divided by the cost of sales gives us our creditor's payment period.
Mm.
So effectively, that we want that to be as long as possible. Just like we want our debtor's period to be as short as possible, we want our creditor's payment to be as long as possible. So we want to make the creditor sweat a little bit.
So if I was evaluating this and stepping back for a moment, if I had a policy that said I want to collect all my debtors in 30 days, and I'd run these numbers every month, and I compare my numbers as we roll. In theory, what I should be seeing is 30 days or less popping out of this equation. And if it's getting, once it's over 30 and it's at 35 and then at 40, at 45, you're starting to realize that actually people are taking, half of your people are taking 60 days to pay you.
Absolutely, because we remember that is an average figure. So if we have an average debtor's collection period of 45 days, that could mean that we have some debtors in there that are 90 days, 120 days. And we know that the longer that carries on, the less likely you actually are to see any of that cash.
Yeah.
And then we might need to write it down. We might need to make a provision for bad debts.
Now, let's talk for a moment about inventory and inventory cycles, because that also must feature here, and holding too much stock or holding too little stock.
Absolutely. So a similar thing to the debtors. We want as few days inventory as possible. And now, I'm sure a lot of people are going out there saying, no, we need lots of inventory in our stores. And that's, we do need to find that balance, because people do need to buy inventory. However, if you looked at inventory a little bit differently and thought exactly what you were saying about that's my money out there. If we're a bookstore and we have books on the shelf, we're selling these books. Remember, every single book on that shelf is effectively money that's on your shelf and not in your bank account. And what happens there is are we also sure that we are going to be able to sell that inventory? Is it genuine? We bought this book for $100. We want to sell it for R300. Maybe that book's worthless. Maybe it's only worth R10. So just like the debtor's day cycle, we want the inventory day cycle also to be as small as possible. Guys, always think about it. It's either inventory or it's cash. It can't be both. Yeah. We want more cash in the business.
Yeah. Okay. Now, I guess as well, there's also that element of having the right type of inventory, and depending on what the nature is of your business, the concept of, let me call it, fast moving inventory versus slow moving inventory. So, if you're stocking, let's use your example earlier, baked beans, that's one inventory cycle. If you're stocking Lamborghinis, that's a very different inventory cycle.
Absolutely.
So you've got to understand the nature of your stock. Now, I guess if we wrap these three concepts together, and I always use the concept of our retailers, because I think they're a prime example of how working capital cycles actually can be used to your advantage in a business. Many retailers actually take stock from their suppliers on, let's call it, on consignment. So they don't pay for the stock up front. They put it on their shelves, and their agreement is, we'll pay you when we sell the item. So in our case, let's go back to the can of baked beans as always. Can of baked beans through at the till point, they swipe. And the moment they swipe the can of baked beans, what's actually happening is the retailer at that point is buying the can of baked beans from the supplier, taking it, let's call it, out of consignment and actually putting it into their stock. And momentarily later, they are now selling the item to you.
Absolutely.
And then what happens is they take your cash or credit card at the till point, and then they pay the supplier in 30, 60, 90 days, whatever.
If they're lucky.
So in my mind, I'm going, hey, that's a really, really good working capital cycle, because the inventory is zero because they've got somebody else to carry the inventory for them.
Correct.
They don't have debtors because they take your cash immediately. Yes. I mean, I don't know about you, but I don't get 30 days to pay for my trolley.
No, they've never said that to me either.
Yeah. So immediate cash or cash or card. And then they take, let's call it, let's call it 60 to 90 days to pay the supplier for the goods that they've just taken on consignment. So if you're that retailer, you're sitting with my cash for 60, 90 days before you have to pay it over to the supplier of the baked beans.
No, and it's a wonderful business model. It's how some of these larger retailers have actually been built, because think about it, they are using someone else's money. like you said, your business partner. But the difference is, you can either use someone else's money or you can use the bank's money.
Yeah.
When you're using the bank's money, you have to pay interest. When you're using someone else's money, your creditor's money, you actually don't pay interest.
Yeah.
So their business model is to use as much as someone else's money for as long as possible.
And pay nothing for it, obviously.
And pay nothing for it. Exactly.
Well, I think that brings us to that awful conclusion. You know, somebody once asked, you know, what is who is this? And they named a brand. Are they retailers or are they banks? And the reality is, they are almost like a bank. They're using other people's money to make their business operate. So that's a very interesting business model. Now, and by the way, I always joke with people. I say, you know, when they swipe the can of beans, they're buying the can of beans. I also say to people, you know, they swipe the can twice. And everybody says, oh, is that when they buy and then when they sell? I said, no, because the computer also can't believe the price of the can of beans.
Precisely, yeah. Exactly.
Okay, so we're using our working capital effectively in our business. We've got the right gross profit margins, and we're getting the business to perform. But I guess for me, there's one final ratio that I always ask about, because at the end of the day, you have a whole lot of, let's call them items that you use in your business. We refer to them as assets,
Yes. Okay,
in the true accounting definition. The things that you own, the resources that you have control over, that you're using to further your business.
Right.
And the thing that I always ask is, so how effectively are we using the assets in this business to make sales and make profits? How do you and you know, I like to, and the reason I like ratios so much, by the way, is that I can compare.
You're an accountant, we love this kind of things.
No, Mike. So I can compare one business to another.
I mean,
if we're not in the same industry, you can't compare absolute numbers. But when you can compare ratios, you know, if I say I'm in an industry and I make a gross profit percentage of 15%, and the guy next door makes 30%. And, you know, his volumes are double mine, and his working capital cycle is half of mine. I'm starting to look at this and going, ooh, okay. So now I'm starting to realize why I should be in his business and not in mine. But when it comes to the usage of the assets in the business and how effectively they're being used, how does one measure that?
Richard, we've got a ratio called the asset turnover ratio, and it's also a great ratio because it compares the balance sheet to the income statement. And the ratio is, you take your sales, so sales slash revenue, that your top line item, whatever you sold it for, and you divide it either by your total assets, if you want the total asset turnover ratio, or the fixed assets. And what that does is that tells you how well have you sweated your assets. I don't know if you guys have heard this term before.
Sweating
your assets.
Yeah, well, I always laugh, because when somebody uses that term, they often, it's derogatory. I'm sweating the assets business.
Maybe I can give you an example. If you're a low-cost airline, you would have bought this airplane. You decide to go into business and you buy an airplane for 100 million rand. Okay, so that is your asset in the business. You've bought that. Mm-hmm. Now you take one trip to Cape Town and you make 1 million rand. So 1 divided by 100 is your – it's 1% is your asset turnover ratio. Mm. Now suddenly you need to increase that ratio, because in any business you want that ratio to be as high as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly we take 2 trips to Cape Town. So we get 2 million rand. However, the asset has still cost us the same. So the asset hasn't changed. Now suddenly we've got 2 divided by 100 or 2%. So that's our asset turnover ratio.
Okay.
How well have we utilized those assets?
So by implication, businesses, I think this is intuitive, and that's why the world has moved where it has, that businesses that have less infrastructure and use less assets but still produce good quality revenues actually have really good returns. So
absolutely.
So I'm thinking of, you know, Uber. biggest, you know, biggest transporter in, around, but absolutely no cars. Airbnb, you know, brilliant, you know, fee income for work, hotel rooms, etc., or accommodation, but they don't own a single hotel or a bed and breakfast.
So what would their asset turnover ratio be?
Well, it would be almost infinite.
Exactly.
I mean, in that sort of environment, the only thing that they're really worrying about is the servers that they run their systems on. And by the way, that's probably also rented. So they probably own very little.
And assets on their balance sheet. Actually, that's
And it's a brilliant business model versus, you know, think about, I think if you look at it, there's been over the years a number of institutions that have gone through these evolutions. You know, you look at banking, for example, back in, you know, many years ago, you were measured by the size of your branch network as your success factor. Nowadays, the size of your branch network actually counts against you because you've got all the bricks and mortar and you actually want cheap electronic channels that aren't on the balance sheet in terms of assets.
And for people wondering why their company has chosen to outsource, it's exactly this. So what do we do when we outsource? We make it someone else's problem. We no longer keep those assets on our books. Maybe beverage companies, when they have a owner-driver program, they no longer own their vehicles. Now it's someone else's problem. They pay for the delivery of the vehicle rather than paying for the vehicle itself.
Yeah.
So their asset turnover ratio automatically goes sky high because it's the same sales divided by a much smaller asset base.
Okay.
Can we talk about that?
So I mean, would it make sense and would it – I mean, I guess as a person in a business, so if I was to step back for a moment from what we've talked about, is you've got to understand in summary your – you've got to understand your business model, whether you're in a high volume, low margin business, or whether you're into higher margins and lower volumes.
Exactly.
You've got to understand what your working capital cycle looks like in terms of what's going to, you know, where the cash gets, and I use the word trapped in the system. So where does the cash sit?
Exactly.
Is it sitting in your bank account, or is it sitting on your shelves in stock? Is it sitting is somebody sitting with your cash to pay you, or do you need to be paying somebody else along the way? And then I guess ultimately in summary, it's a case of, okay, and how effectively can you use all of the assets that you've got within your business to actually produce the required outcome?
Absolutely. Richard, I think you got it just right there. Also wanted to add to your ratio, one of the reasons why I really enjoy ratio is because you said you can compare it to other businesses. You can also compare it to your own business, but through years.
Through the years,
and also your different divisions. So if you're a major conglomerate and you have a food division or a clothing division or anything like that, you can use these exact same ratios, the profitability, the working capital ratios, the asset turnover ratios in those different businesses. You can also compare a South African company with an American company, so it's across currencies as well.
Yeah, so so the issues of comparability kind of disappear when you're looking
at
ratios. So, you know, if I'm looking at ratios for a company in South Africa and a ratio for a company in Africa, I can expect to see ratios are at least consistent.
They are. Whether you're using Naira, whether you're using US dollars, whether you're using yen, we can come to the same percentage. Is it a percentage? Is it one times? Whatever it is like that. And which is why a lot of analysts use it, which is why a lot of accountants use these ratios, because they are so comparable.
Mm. Now, I mean, I guess the one question that still goes begging is, so how does one benchmark one's ratios? Because if I'm a small business person, how do I know that number that I've got coming out is right? Where do I go to get a sense of what these numbers should be?
That's a good question. I think one of the areas that you can go to is using an existing business. So use, if you are going into retail, have a look at some of the other retailers, have a look at what their ratios are, and then benchmark it accordingly.
Mm.
If you are charging what they're charging and not making it, as we established, you have to raise your prices. Is that going to correlate with a drop in volume? Probably. And that's how it works. It's the way economics works. The higher the volume that you're doing, it's normally the lower the margin that we're getting on it. So that's important from that point of view. So I would say do some research, have a look at some of your competitors, have a look at some of the other industries, and we can benchmark something along those lines.
Yeah. Okay. Mike, thank you very much. It's been great chatting to you.
Thank you.
And yeah, looking forward to spending some time with those rashers.
And don't eat all those baked beans at the same time. Okay.
Good, thank you. That was Michael Hinton joining us. Thanks very much for that. Next up, our conversation with the entrepreneur and founder of the first restaurant on Vilakazi Street, Sokumisi Makubela, if I've got that pronounced correct. He'll be joining us shortly.
This is CliffCentral.com.